Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, the San Francisco Symphony's upcoming Soundbox show is about dreams, then a coming-of-age film about a Bay Area teenager who is trying to balance school, her social life, and concern for her dying mother, then one of the featured poets for my upcoming event about love. And today's show is about liminal spaces and love. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. That beautiful music you hear is a performance by violinist Alexi Kinney. The artist from Palo Alto is curating the San Francisco Symphony's event called Soundbox Dream Awake. And if you haven't heard of or been to a Soundbox show, it's not your typical classical concert. It actually takes place backstage at Davie Symphony Hall. And you can experience this sound immersive multimedia event on February 6th and 7th. And joining me to tell us more about Soundbox Dream Awake and his music is Alexi Kinney. Hey, Alexi.
Hi, so nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you here, and I want to hear about this psychedelic, sound immersive, beautiful multimedia show. But before we even get into that, tell me, did the violin call you, or did you find a violin? How did that work?
You know, I can't quite remember because I was 4 years old when I started playing violin, but my mom says that I would always perk up at the sound of instruments, and you know, she would be playing this, that, the other thing. I'd be in the crib, and anytime she'd play an instrument or an instrumental thing, I would just kind of like, oh, perk up.
Really?
So even from when I was 1, 2 years old, she was scheming of what I might be playing, what instrument she would get me. It just so happened that at the end of our block, there was a violin teacher, and so we went in, followed a kid with a violin case, and that was my first teacher.
Wow.
So it felt quite fateful, actually.
I love hearing stories how when people were babies, like, you know, they just kind of knew, like, it was in them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so special. And again, you're from Palo Alto, but based in the city now, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm trying to imagine little Alexi in the crib in Palo Alto.
Yes.
Hearing a violin, like, That's so, so cute. Okay, so for people who don't know, I know Soundbox has been around for, what, a decade, I guess?
I think I heard this is their 13th or 14th season, actually.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So what is Soundbox? Because when I was reading the description, I thought it was just really, really cool. And I know it's gotten national coverage in the past, so.
Yeah, I think the general concept is that, you know, if you think of your typical symphony concert as being in the symphony hall, you know, it's a big stage. It's kind of a grand setting, thousands of people in the audience, or at least thousands of seats, and, you know, big orchestra on stage. Soundbox was born out of the desire to do something within Symphony Hall at Davie Symphony Hall, but create an experience that's more immersive and more casual. And so it takes place in, essentially, they turn it into a black box. It's sort of the backstage area of the symphony. It's a rehearsal loading dock space.
Okay.
But you would never know that when you walk in because they've hired the two people who work to transform the space are Adam and Luke, who are wonderful video projection artist and lighting designer, respectively. And the whole team at the symphony works to sort of transform the space based on whatever the guest curator wants to do with it.
Okay.
And so I've basically been meeting with the team there over the past year or so, kind of discussing not only the program of music, but what the experience should feel like and what the visuals should look like and what the trajectory of the evening will look like. So it's sort of, it's a hybrid. You know, there's no like theater per se, but we're doing some light staging. I'll be moving around the space as I play. There's multiple stages within this one space. Audience is kind of sprinkled throughout.
Okay.
And it's in three acts rather than your typical, like, you know, symphony on the second half of a classical program.
Mm-hmm.
I personally wanted to make this more about new contemporary music. A lot of my friends are composers, and I wanted to feature them on this program. So there's kind of a lot of, like, it's almost, I like to think of it as injecting kind of new energy, new blood into classical music.
And I know, yeah, and I understand too, that's the purpose of Soundbox. And so the title of this show that you're curating is Dream Awake. So tell us what's that about and what can people expect?
Yeah, so the way I tend to program is more about energy flow. So I basically, for this program, I knew I wanted to present three pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of things swirling in my brain all the time. And I'm like, there was one piece in particular that's for solo violin and solo soprano. So I invited my friend Lucy Fitzgibbon, who's also, she's from Davis, California. Mm-hmm. So she's also a local living in New York now, a wonderful soprano. And she and I will begin the program with a selection from Kafka Fragments by Georgi Kurtag, mm-hmm. who's still alive. He's turning 100 this year. but he wrote this set of pieces and the lyrics are all little fragments by Franz Kafka. And one of the fragments translates to asleep, awake, miserable life. And so as dark as that sounds, I kind of was inspired by that little fragment and rode with it, created this whole program kind of based on the idea of that in-between space, you know, where we're not quite asleep, you're not quite awake, you're not quite sure what is real, you're not quite sure what, if you're dreaming, if you're not. And, you know, that, I think I took that into a direction of like, well, maybe that has to do with like psychedelic, you know, when you're on a substance and like you're really not sure what's going on. You're Alice in Wonderland, you know. So the whole second act of this three-act program is that sort of dream sequence where it's going to be extremely colorful, extremely kind of surreal. And all the pieces that I programmed support that.
And I'm thinking, too, because cocktails would be served, would be sold there.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Because when I was looking at just the videos, it kind of reminded me of like, not quite like a speakeasy, but kind of like a speakeasy and a nightclub and a theater and a movies and a classical concert, like all combined. And it was really, really cool, though. So I'm thinking just the music, that's going to be really, really neat, too. I love that kind of psychedelic energy and vibe going. So that sounds really, really like a lot of fun. Do you dream? Do you hear music in your dreams? Because you're a musician. I'm just curious.
That's such a good question. I feel like I've had anxiety dreams about performing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of performing artists probably have the same thing. I'm not sure if I ever dream music. That's a really good question, though.
Yeah, I just wondered. Because of the show.
Yeah. I just wondered. I have vivid dreams all the time. And it's one thing that I love in life, actually.
Oh, nice.
I
me
love
too sometimes.
Having dreams.
Yeah.
And remembering them, you know, the little that you can remember.
Yeah.
But yeah, the wilder the better.
Yeah. Sometimes, like, depending on the dream, sometimes I'll get my journal and like write notes.
Yeah,
about
same.
It. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's funny because I know like my journalist professors, and I do this too now. They used to tell me when I was in journalism school that they would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about a story that they covered years ago, thinking about, did I write that sentence right? Did I have the right source? And now I'm starting to do that. But I can relate to the having some anxiety dreams about your profession. I'm thinking of Soundbox because it's out of the box. What creative liberties do you have curating this show that you don't have in a traditional classical concert? And not necessarily just saying just the elements that are there, but how do you feel as a creator as far as really stepping out of the box with this type of production?
Yeah, it's really special for me. So I'm a violinist, right? And a lot of what I do is play music that was composed 100, 200, 300 years ago. And if I'm going to play with a symphony, usually it's going to be a concerto, which is, you know, a solo instrument with a big orchestra behind it. And so I think, you know, one thing that I've done a lot of in the past few years is try to break the mold a little bit in terms of my own programming. So I'm very passionate about new contemporary music, living composers. I've commissioned a lot of music. I have a solo program that's just violin alone with projections created by a friend of mine named Xuan. It's about a 65-minute sort of experiential program, not unlike Soundbox.
Okay.
But the thing that I love or have loved about getting to program Soundbox is that there's no limit on what instruments you can use. And, you know, I don't have to play in every piece as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I was able to program one of these, the dream pieces of mine is called Pleiades by this Greek composer, Xenakis. And it's for, the title of this movement is called Skins, and it's for all skinned drums. And so there's six players playing like six sets of timpani.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine just the sheer sound in the space of six timpanis.
I think it's because it's like a warehouse kind of space. Right?
Yeah. 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 So getting to program that kind of thing, you know, in my quote unquote daily life is kind of impossible. But when I proposed that to the symphony, they were like, oh, yeah, of course we can do that. So, you know, it really felt quite limitless for me. And that's a really, really exciting place to be as an artist and as a creative.
Yeah. Limitless, that word, and hearing the word yes, that's like a dream for an artist, right?
Absolutely. And I consider myself just so, so lucky to not only have had this opportunity, but to have had it with San Francisco Symphony, because this is my home, you know.
It's, yeah.
I live so close to Symphony Hall. I grew up in the youth orchestra attached to the San Francisco Symphony. And so it's kind of mind-blowing that I have this opportunity, you know.
Yeah. No, that's exciting. I want to play a clip just to give listeners an idea of your skill, your brilliance. And my producer picked this song because he loved Justin Bieber and Ariana Grande. but here's a cover of the song Stuck With You, and here's you playing the violin. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with violinist Alexi Kenny. He's curating the concert Soundbox Dream Awake, and you can watch him perform at Davie Symphony Hall in San Francisco on February 6th and the 7th. Before this interview, I was telling you how I saw this really cool video that you shot during the quarantine, and you're in this massive sculpture that's a maze, and you're playing the violin, and there's great aerial shots of you doing. It's really beautiful. Just with the art of the structure and then the sound that's coming from your instrument. And I understand you like architecture.
I do, yes.
which is really great. How does that fold into you being a violin player? And I just noticed, too, looking at your Instagram, just some of the cool things and the videos that you make. So how does that fold in with your artistry with music?
You know, I really think of music three-dimensionally. You know, obviously it's something that is kind of abstract anyway, but the act of producing music for me and playing the violin, it's a full body experience. Mm-hmm. First of all, it takes me over mind, body, and spirit when I play violin. But I also think of like using the bow as some sort of like calligraphy brush, or I think in terms of densities, in terms of weight, in terms of shape, color, you know, these things that I think are kind of artists' palettes, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can say that, you know, that's because I love architecture, or I love architecture because I love music, but for me it's all holistic. Like, it's just one art, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess that's one thing I love about art is that it's so, you know, you can find these connections and just really draw parallels between everything. And the video that you're referencing was shot at the Donham Estate, which is up in Sonoma.
Okay.
And there's all these sculptures. If you haven't been there or looked it up, I'd highly recommend you take a look. Just a lot of these sculptures have pattern and metal and reflection and all these elements that I think are, you know, both things that I think about physically when I play the violin, mentally when I'm looking at a piece of music, and I think it's reflected in the creation of compositions as well, you know.
I'm excited to see how you'll bring that into this upcoming show, because the way you use architecture and the music, and I'm thinking of just playing with this idea of dream spaces and dreamscapes and being awake, and yeah, I think it's gonna be nice. Yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah, I think so too. Alexi, it's been so nice to talk to you and meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anytime. I've been speaking with violinist Alexi Kinney. Watch her perform in Soundbox Dream Awake at Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco on February 6th and the 7th. Coming up, a film about a Bay Area teen navigating ballet, a crush, and her mother's terminal illness. Stay with us. Listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. The indie film Still Life takes readers back to teen life in 1999. Corded phones in your bedroom, reading profiles of Claire Danes in 17 Magazine, Y2K hysteria. I remember those days. Some of you know what I'm talking about. But for the main character, Daphne, who is 15, this is around the time of her life when her mother dies from leukemia. Still Life is inspired by screenwriter and director Lauren Shapiro's experience. The film was shot in the Bay Area. It's screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on February 7th as part of SF Indie Fest. And joining me in studio is Lauren Shapiro. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. And I understand you're based in Rockridge, so I want to give a shout-out to Rockridge. I know people don't shout-out Rockridge, but I'm going to shout-out Rockridge. So you have such a really interesting background. You have a doctorate in developmental psychology.
That's right.
And you taught in the doctoral program at Wright Institute, mm-hmm. and then you decided to go into films. I imagine having a psychology background comes in handy when you're making films.
Well, the secret is that I always wanted to be a filmmaker and a writer.
Okay.
And I sort of studied stories as a way, I think, to be close to them still.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened then is in graduate school, I sort of confessed my interest to a filmmaker friend, Kara Harold, who's now at Syracuse University. And she took me under her wing and got her on her set. But yeah, definitely the psychology has come in handy as well, especially with directing. It informed a lot of the way that I would communicate to my characters, to my actors, what was going on with those characters.
Yeah. I imagine too, even just the writing, like just the writing process. What does Still Life mean?
I chose that title for a bunch of reasons. So one is that I really think about this film as a portrait of a specific place and time.
Mm.
Another is that what I'm trying to get across with the film is that even when sort of this monumental trauma is happening, still life is going on.
Yes.
Right? And that's what I'm trying to show, is how everything happens all at once. The comedy and the love and the drama and the tragedy, mm-hmm. all is wrapped up together. But then, of course, I'm playing with stills in the film, right? Like, I realize that the film itself is a still life. The film itself is, you know, kind of this moment in time that's frozen. So there's a lot of different ideas at play there.
Yeah, it's funny when you lose someone, it's like the world still goes on, and it's a strange feeling.
Exactly.
And you have to keep living. I want to talk about your mother, because in the film, actress Michelle Levy, who's a UC Davis drama professor, she plays your mother, and the character seems so just full of life and kind of like that doesn't really always have a filter. Like, you don't know what she's going to say.
Yep.
Tell us more. about your mother.
Yeah.
And she seemed a lot of fun, too, that character.
Yes, yeah. She was. She was a rabble-rouser. She was an activist. She was a therapist. She was a social worker. Right. My parents met teaching at San Francisco State. My dad just retired after 50 years there in the social work department.
Oh, wow.
So she cared very much about the power of stories to affect social change and was a major inspiration for the idea to tell the story in the first place. But, yeah, people who know her tear up immediately when she comes on because that's how she was. She was just like this life force, unstoppable. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was it something she used to say about writing a story? What was it?
Well, she invited me to come and chronicle what was happening to her. She had hoped that this would become a film. So even very early on in the film, she says, you know, in the film adaptation of my battle with leukemia, who will play me? So that was a dream of hers. She had a photographer taking pictures of what was happening to her, and we share some of those pictures at the end. And some of those pictures include me taking notes of the story.
How was that for you? And I'm thinking of this theme of still life. You know, in this character, Daphne, she has to go to ballet lessons. She has a little brother. She's, you know, she's crushing on this guy. I mean, and trying to get good grades to go to college. And then I'm thinking on top of that, to chronicle what was happening. How was that helpful? Was it therapeutic? Was it helpful? Was it heavy?
Yeah. My mom, Reva Lee, she got her PhD in medical sociology at UCSF, and she worked with Anselm Strauss, who was one of the founding fathers of grounded theory, and his focus was on illness and death. Mm-hmm. So she actually had lost her mom at a young age. My grandma died when my mom was 13.
Oh.
And so she used all of the skills that she had learned about studying death and dying by looking at people's stories and turned that on to her own experience. And so I think she tried to have that carry over to me, the power of when something bad's happening to you, take good notes and make a story that could help other people and potentially affect social change.
Wow. Okay. So that's interesting that she had that a similar history.
Yes. So I grew up with that story my whole life. And so she really imparted to me also that idea that she would say, you never know, often in a good way, like, you go for it. You never know what's going to happen. But also, you never know what's going to happen to you. So you have to live your life to your fullest while you can, because we all could be gone any second. You don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's part of where her love for life came from, was she from an early age knew how short life is.
Yeah. And that's what I liked about the characters, that even though she was going through something, you know, really hard, she still, like, had life in her hands, and she was still living vibrantly, red lipstick, you know, bright colored scarves on her head. So, yeah, and, you know, you took an interesting approach to portraying grief and death, because in a way it was very quiet. It was very quiet. It wasn't like, and there's nothing wrong with that. People grieve and process things in different ways. It wasn't like, oh my God, you know, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like argumentative. It felt very still. Yeah.
My hope is that I'm portraying grief in as authentic way as possible. And obviously for everyone, it's different. But I really hope that people who've experienced loss can resonate with the film and see themselves in it. Because I think so often in the media, it's portrayed as this, you know, sort of, you know, there's a crescendo of music.
Right.
You know. And I wanted to portray how it really felt for me with hopes that, yeah, other people feel seen and less alone.
Yeah, yeah. And the actress who plays the lead character, is her name Anika or Annika?
Annika.
Annika Jensen. She's from Alameda. Shout out to Annika. She did a great job of playing a teenager. And I grew up in the 90s. When I saw that corded, y'all remember that those corded phones, the ones that are see-through where you can see all the, like, the mechanisms in the phone, that took me back. You know, that took me back. And then you had news clips from, like, Cron and KTVU from 1999 as we're anticipating Y2K. So, yeah, to be a teenager back then was just, yeah. It was a special time.
That's part of what I'm trying to portray, too, is I think not just for Daphne, the character, but for a lot of people, 1999 was kind of this before time. It was a time of innocence. It was before a lot of things happened. So we're kind of hanging in balance just before. So I'm also hoping to transport people back to that.
Yeah. And the liminal, the theme of liminal in the film, Daphne's 15, about to turn 16, life and death. You know, she's in these spaces. I also felt, too, sometimes that, like, she was kind of left out of the loop about things, like, about her mother's, you know, status, her mother's health.
Yes.
I feel like sometimes, and her father did the best he could, But yeah, I feel like sometimes they left her out.
Yes, yeah. That's part of what I'm trying to portray too, is what that was like to have this kind of like fog in between, right? Of not really knowing what's fully going on. And the telephone is kind of a symbol of that sometimes, of, you know, just out of reach, her mom being, you know, the connection being compromised somehow.
Yeah. Okay, I noticed, because even sometimes the way she held the telephone, like I could tell it was, yeah, it was something important. Yeah, in the film. So, you know, Daphne's quiet. She's very active in school. She you know, she dances ballet. She's in AP classes. So is she just like how you were when you were a teenager? Or is there a difference?
Annika is wearing my actual clothes from high school in the film.
Really?
And my actual honors English teacher plays herself in the film. So definitely there is a lot of me infused.
Okay. What high school did you go to?
Las Lomas in Walnut Creek.
Okay. Wow. Now, where was it shot? Was it shot at?
No. The interior high school scenes were shot at Head Royce in Oakland.
Oh, at Head Royce. Okay.
And then we shot the exteriors at a bunch of other local high schools and other schools in the Bay Area.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely I tried to infuse as much of myself and the real story into it as possible. Obviously, it's not 100%, but
right,
I think
right.
those personal details really actually make a difference. Okay. So like Michelle, who plays my mom, is wearing my mom's actual turbans and scarves. And
wow.
Yeah, my mom's bathrobe is featured in the film. So a lot of me. It's my heart up on the screen, this film. Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. That definitely is your heart. How was that for you to just see, to see that part of your life reenacted?
It was an incredible gift. I mean, just being able to make art with people in general is my favorite thing to do. It's the best. I had hoped it would be therapeutic. I still have a lot of grief work to do myself, and I had hoped that, but you know, we're a really scrappy production, so some days we didn't have production assistants, so I was getting the coffee and setting up craft services and taking out the trash. And so when we filmed the death scene, for example, I was really focused on eliciting certain performances and also thinking how many tacos we need to order for lunch. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't until watching the trailer that it was really a cathartic moment for me, because I had so much empathy for Daphne, the character, and then that was me, right?
Yeah.
So I was able to kind of feel for the first time in some ways, something started to thaw.
Okay. And I also imagine, too, is empowering, because you're telling your story, how you want your story told.
Definitely. Yeah. I think a lot of trauma work and therapy looks at retelling stories, and this was an opportunity for me to be the director of a story that happened to me. So
yeah.
Still processing, but definitely a huge gift.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with screenwriter and director Lauren Shapiro. Her film Still Life is screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco will be screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on February 7th as part of SF Indie Fest. Okay, so many of us remember when we were in high school, we had a crush on somebody that we probably shouldn't have been having a crush on. Andrew Bovis, that's the name of the
yes.
gentleman? Okay. Andrew was a good actor because I didn't like his character. And I was like, I know that's not who Andrew is, but he was convincing. So he plays Daphne's love interest. And he catches her in this liminal space, because sometimes he's hot, sometimes he's cold. And I also thought, for me, he represented the unsteadiness of her life. And I questioned, I was like, is he going to be there for her? This is a spoiler-free conversation. But, talk about this character, because I wanted to smack him.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I should say, too, that I think she doesn't really let him into the story very much also.
Mm-hmm.
I think he doesn't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And
That's true.
That's part of what I'm trying to do with this film, too, is almost like a grief public service announcement. Like, there could be so many stories unfolding all around you that you don't know about. So to try to kind of, I don't know, make space for some grace for people, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think you're right that maybe he's a little bit of a distraction for her at that time, just like her mom also is kind of there, but just out of reach. I think she experiences something similar with him.
Yeah. And then, too, you know, how do you have those conversations when you're 15, 16? Even though these are conversations that is hard for us in our 40s and 50s, maybe to have to. Okay, I'll give him a little slack because I wanted to.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm saying that is because he was kind of like a know-it-all to me. And, you know, I mean, he's young, right? He was young. But But that's true. That's right. Daphne didn't tell him everything. So
right.
Yeah.
But also, definitely, I had a friend who watched the film and said, "We all know a Jason. We've all
yes, we do. We all know a Jason." So yeah, that was an interesting character and his presence. And you mentioned some people in the film that are close to you or that were in your life at that time. And the cast is heavily made up of actors from the Bay Area, particularly the East Bay, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What did it mean for you to have East Bay artists in this film? You have family and friends in there. What did that mean for you making this film as you're telling your story?
Yes, it was so important to me. This film is a love letter to the Bay Area on so many levels. I wanted to show, you know, the blue of the sky in October and the red of the leaves at the end of November. I love this place so much. And I wanted to show that love also by hiring local cast and crew. And I should say, too, a lot of this crew are women, too. So we have Anjali Sundaram, who's professor at CCSF. Mm-hmm. Ellie Vanderlip is our editor. She's also director of education and outreach at Shapeshifter Cinema in Oakland. Brooke Beeson. I think these are all SF State grads also. So
nice.
I care very much about the arts in this place, and I wanted to help boost careers as best I could and just showcase the incredible talent of so many local artists. And then, you know, it was really special to weave friends and family in. I actually was really quite moved. I have a 7-year-old daughter. She might be listening at home. Hi, Eddie. And she appears in the film not long after the portrayal of the mother's death. Actually, mm-hmm. the family goes out for burritos after the mother dies. Yeah. And my daughter is actually featured as an extra in the background at the taqueria. So again, just like including my clothes and my teacher in the film, I think it lends something really special to have some of that heart sort of distributed throughout the cast as well. Yeah. Witnessing and showing up in the art in that way.
And is this your first film?
Yes.
So, and we have about a minute, a little under a minute left. What has this done for you as an artist to make this? Are you like, I want to make more?
Oh yeah, it's just whetting my appetite. It was the highlight of my life. I loved every single second from writing the script to, you know, doing color correction. So I'm hungry for more and I can't wait to make the next film.
Any feedback that you've gotten from the film or anybody who's watched the film and it touched them or they can relate to that you treasure?
Definitely. What I was hoping for, like I said, is it would especially resonate for folks who've experienced loss. And mm-hmm. that's what I've seen so far, is that people for whom this story is close, it does really touch them. And so I'm really grateful for that. But also, yeah, people who live during this time or who live in this place, it really, yeah, transports them to something they know and love. And yeah. I hope they enjoy.
Well, it was, you know, it was nice to go back in the past. And thank you for being so vulnerable and courageous, you know, to expose us and let us learn, but also for your own self and for your own healing. So thank you so much, Lauren.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It really was a pleasure.
Yeah, anytime. Lauren Shapiro's film, Still Life, will be screening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on February 7th as part of SF Indie Fest. Next up, we're getting warmed up for Valentine's Day with my next Sights and Sounds event, Love and Poetry, after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. During turbulent times like we're living in today, art reminds us that we're human. Artists remind us that no matter what is going on, we still feel, that we can still notice something beautiful, that we still love. Next Thursday, February 12th, I'm hosting my pre-Valentine's Day event. It's called Sights and Sounds After Dark, The Love Factor, and there will be music and poetry. And my next guest is one of the artists performing. Norma Smith is a poet and social researcher. Her book is called Home Remedy, and her poems and stories have so much heart, and I've known Norma for some time, and I'm so happy she's here. Welcome, Norma.
Thank you. I'm so inspired by your other guests. I don't know. I'm processing.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for inviting me. And wow.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Exactly. I know. You know. It's funny when the show comes together so naturally, and it's always interesting how when the artists come together, there's always this common thread, you know, between, you know, what everyone's doing. But yeah, definitely kind of take that in. Got some journal reflecting to do right after the show. Yeah. You know, so Norma, you performed at our first Sights and Sounds After Dark event and you wanted to come back. I said, okay, Norma. So what made you want to come back and read again?
Oh, well, I loved that. It was, I mean, the audience was really wonderful. And the other, I think I knew some of the other writers.
Yeah.
It was just so warm, and I loved it. And I read, I read prose pieces.
Yes, you did. Yeah,
they were. One of them was kind of snarky, which I enjoy. So I just wanted to say yes. I like your work, and I want to support you, and. There's a lot of love in writing.
Yeah, there's a lot of love. Well, I appreciate that you say you're willing to come back on, and I appreciate your voice. And because you gave, you know, you talked about experiences being an elder and love and losing a partner, and then you know that older people they still get down. So you talked about all of that stuff. So y'all know what I mean, like getting down. But but yeah, so it was great. So like I was just so happy that you performed and wanted to come back. So Norma, I was reading your book, and we're gonna talk later about what you're gonna be performing this coming in a couple of weeks. But I was reading your book Home Remedy, and in the first poem you write, quote, "I heard myself say, all poems are love poems for me because all that I write is an attempt at understanding, and that must be an act of love." What beautiful words. How is attempting to understand an act of love? I love that.
Well, I think what Lauren said really rang a bell with me too. My mom was a sociologist, sort of partly by training, but also by personality. And she always talked to me about what was going on in the world in an analytical way, in a way to help me analyze what was going on. And so understanding has always been really, really important to me. And poetry has always been really important to me. When I was really little, I didn't speak. Mm. I wrote instead of speaking. I had feelings. So understanding my own feelings has been really important to me. And that poem, I was going to read that poem. I will read it if you want.
Yeah, please still read it. Yes, yes.
It was also about my father's death and our relationship, and trying to grapple with our relationship. And so I was talking myself into that truth.
Yeah.
All poems are love poems because it's an aiming at understanding. Mm-hmm. And I can read the poem and then we could talk.
Let's wait, because I want to ask a couple more questions.
So the poem also says, that sounds true, but is that true?
Okay, well, you know, since you're going to, let's just read the poem. Okay, yeah, let's read the poem. Okay. We're gonna let the muse guide us. So let's read the poem.
Okay. It's the first, as you say, it's the first poem in the book, and it's called "What He Left Me With." On his deathbed, my father heard me say, "I love you." It was pro forma, I thought. Who was I to withhold anything he'd never offered me? "Oh, good," he said. "I knew you either loved me or hated me." Amazing, I thought. The one thing in his life he wasn't sure of. I have heard myself say, all poems are love poems, because all that I write is an attempt at understanding, and that must be an act of love. Sounds good, but still, I'm not sure it's true. For certain, between us, after all these years of death, you're long scattered to the winds, and I am still trying to figure you out, frail, the way you were at the end, and I, the strong one now. Surely not hate. but something much more complicated.
This is such a beautiful piece. And again, that piece is called What He Left Me With. Yeah.
So it's the complication. It's about how complicated love is.
Yeah.
And how if you don't talk, I mean, you can love someone and not communicate, and then you're not sure. You know, that's the complication.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said that, you know, when you were younger, you didn't speak. You would write how you felt. So was that when your mother gave you a journal? Is that why she gave you a journal when you were
little? That's right. Well, I mean, this is complicated, too. I've had several theories about this. My mother's mother lived with us when I was young, from the time I was about 5 or so until I was in high school. Mm-hmm. She was not an easy person. Mm-hmm. She was really harsh. And she would say, "Don't contradict me," which of course shut me up, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't ask questions, because, right. okay, if I can't question you, then I won't say anything.
Right.
So it was, so I didn't speak. I mean, that's, but I did write. I wrote from the time I learned to read, really. That's over 70 years now. And writing really was the central activity of my life mm-hmm. all those years. But then when I was about 11, my mother saw that I still wasn't really talking much. And that's when she gave me a journal. And it wasn't until really I was in college that I started a practice of writing every day.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I was still writing every day, but journal and poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking up more about your background, and you were born in Detroit, you grew up in Fresno. And then, too, you know, speaking of your mother, I was reading an article in Easy Street magazine that Professor Rochelle Spencer, she used to live in the Bay Area, but she's now teaching on the East Coast. Shout out to Rochelle, because sometimes she listens. And she interviewed you, and you talked about your mother's side of the family were activists in Detroit. Detroit is such a special city. Even if you're born there, I don't know what it is about people from Detroit. They got some special sauce when they come into the world. And major artists would stay at the family home. Their mother's family home, like Paul Robeson, they would come into town and stay there. Did hearing those stories influence you as an artist?
Oh, absolutely. Well, as an artist and as an activist, as a person right. in the world. So my mom, I think I probably said this when Rochelle interviewed me, is my mother. So my mother's father was a revolutionist in Russia, and he came to this country. Because the Tsarist police were after him, and also his father was after him. He wanted him, my grandfather, to be a rabbi, and my grandfather was an atheist. So, you know,
yeah.
So he left right after the revolutionary activity in 1905, and he ended up in Detroit in the building trades, and so there. Circle of friends were anarchists and socialists,
right?
In the Jewish community, and that's how people like Robeson and the Bengali poet Tagore stayed there, because they couldn't stay at a hotel in the 30s,
right?
And 40s in Detroit, it was segregated, and so. My grandparents had a house, a big house, and loved guests, and loved the opportunity to have conversations with these amazing people.
Right. Wow.
And that's how that happened.
And Paul Robeson had been blacklisted out of Hollywood, and yeah.
But even just as a black man, he was not welcome in a hotel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think probably the black community didn't have the resources. I mean, it's another complicated thing.
Right, right. But I'm just thinking people that are, like, considered rebels. So that's what was interesting. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with writer Norma Smith. She's reading at our Sights and Sounds After Dark, The Love Factor event. And other artists who are part of that lineup are musician Cadence Miles, along with poets Cassandra Dallet and Kevin Dublin. And that's happening at our KALW downtown venue at 220 Montgomery Street on Thursday, February 12th. So I understand you're going to be reading about some family members and love. Is that what you got?
Well, I could. I mean, my main love right now.
This is at the event. This is at the upcoming event. I know we're kind of talking about what you might be doing.
Yeah. Right. So my main love interest right now is my 8-year-old granddaughter, 9-year-old.
Because you know she's going to correct you.
Well, she's 9 going on 30.
Right.
And we have really interesting conversations, including conversations about trust and love. And she asks me questions that I'm not prepared to answer to a 9-year-old.
Okay.
And so we've had conversations about like some disagreements about what she has the right to know.
Okay.
And she is an her arguments are the piece I want to read probably is called My Granddaughter the Logician, and she can argue. She's persuaded me of some things I was pretty clear that I didn't want to divulge.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I have at least one little prose piece about her, and I think there are all kinds of love.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, and that's what the event is about. It's, you know, I told the performers that we're open to all different types of love that you can express, you know, in your performance. So what has she taught you about love? This little 9-year-old and a 30-year-old woman's body, a 30-year-old woman in a 9-year-old's body. What has she taught you about love?
Well, the thing is, it's she's taught me to stand my ground intellectually, mm-hmm. the way she does, so that sometimes she doesn't get to hear. I mean, so she wanted to know whether I still liked her father's father,
okay,
whom I've been separated from since my son was 3. Oh. And I said, I don't think I'm going to answer that right now. And she said, no, I need to know. I want to know. Mm. And my feeling was there were things that she couldn't understand.
Right.
And I didn't, and I hope she never understood. You know why? I knew the answer to the question, right. But I didn't. She has a relationship with this person and they love each other. So we were playing in her room when she asked me this question. And I said, I'll answer you when you're 40. I'll answer that question when you can understand it. And she said, you're not going to be here when I'm 40.
Oh my goodness.
So I said, okay, I'll try to hang on until you're 20. So that's actually my commitment to her now.
Okay. All right, now so Damian Minor got that look because we have black grandmothers. So it's like, you talk like that, you're in trouble.
But before that, she said, you have to answer me. And I said, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
And she said, you're not leaving this room until you answer me.
Woo! So, these kids are lucky. Because if I talk like that, and my mother's listening.
So this is the thing. But one of the things I learned from that interaction is she trusts me to be honest with
you. To be honest with you, yeah.
So that's what I learned about love from my granddaughter.
You know, and to like the fact, it's funny because, you know, the fact that she wants to know that information, right? And and like, why does she want to know the information? But it's too, it's helping to understand, you know, the world and probably, and maybe she doesn't even really understand, you know that, but like understanding relationships and.
She understands a lot about, we've talked too about friendships and the nature of trust.
Yeah.
And and I talked to her about my friendships too. And we agree that we have some friends that we absolutely love, some friends we trust with anything, mm-hmm. and other friends we trust Not with everything. And to hear her say that and articulate it, I mean, wow.
And trust is so important when it comes to love. It's so important when it comes to love. Norma, we have about 45 seconds left. I want to know, I talked about just the times we live in and how divisive things are right now. And I know just your background, coming from a family of activists, coming from a family of, creatives and thinkers. What role does art and poetry serve in your life at this moment?
Good question. Well, from October of 2023 until just very recently, everything I started to write ended up being a poem or a story about Gaza. So that's one answer. And now I'm also writing about men in bulletproof vests, so I guess I've advanced. So it's being a little, but because of that first poem, it is all about love. I mean, and that's, I mean, the other thing about that poem, about all poems being love poems, is
We gotta
writing
wrap
that
up.
poem helped me know what it is that I know. And that's a role of writing and art, that you find out what you know by writing it down.
All right, Norma, thank you so much for those words of wisdom.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with writer Norma Smith. See her perform at our event, Sights and Sounds After Dark, The Love Factor, and that'll be happening next Thursday, 7 p.m. at KLW's downtown San Francisco venue. And you can go to klw.org/events to RSVP and get Norma's book, Home Remedy, from blacklawrencepress.com. We'll have a link on our website. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show today. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. This Sunday afternoon, February 1st, I'll be speaking at the Chase Center's Thrive City Black History Month celebration. You can go to you can RSVP at thrivecity.com, and make sure to RSVP for my Sights and Sounds After Dark event at klw.org/events. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.